We looked at the beginning of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 last Sunday at the issue of celibacy and marriage, or singleness and marriage. Now then, in verse 10, Paul gets into a new section of a new topic, and that is the topic of divorce. It's probable that this is among the questions that the Corinthians had written to Paul. They had apparently written to him asking some questions, and he's now answering questions that they have posed to him. Let me read verse 10 through 16, and please follow along in your own Bibles. Now, to those who have been married, I exhort, not I, but rather the Lord, a wife not to be separated from a husband. But if she has already been separated, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband. Also, a husband is not to dismiss a wife. And to the rest, I say, I, not the Lord, if any brother has an unbelieving wife, and she is pleased to make a home with him, let him not dismiss her. And if any wife has an unbelieving husband, and he's pleased to make a home with her, let her not dismiss her husband. For the unbelieving husband has been made holy by his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been made holy by the brother. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbelieving man divorces himself, let him be divorced. In this, the brother or sister has not been bound. Yet it is in peace that God has called us. For what have you known, wife, if you will save your husband? Or what have you known, husband, if you will save your wife? With divorce rates like they are today, I'm sure everybody here knows somebody that's been divorced, or maybe has experienced it yourself. We know the heartaches involved in that. I'm reminded of a cousin who became more and more forgetful and irritable over time until his wife couldn't just got set up and divorced him. Turned out he had a brain tumor that was affecting his personality, and he had to go through all the difficulties of brain surgery and memory recovery all alone. Think of a friend who decided he was actually a woman. And he got the so-called sex change surgery and started hitting on other men. And I got a phone call from his wife. Can I divorce him? He wants to stay in my house with me, but I don't think this is right. Can I divorce him? I think of the pastor whose wife ran off with another elder. Think of a woman who married a man who claims to be a Christian, but he regularly gets drunk and beats her and beats her son up and has threatened to kill them. She's read a book by a popular pastor that says that adultery is the only grounds for divorce. Abuse is not, and so she doesn't feel like she can divorce him. I'm sure we've all got stories and questions, too, about whether divorce is okay or not, and when it is and when it isn't. And I can't ever remember hearing a pastor preach a sermon on this in a church that I've attended, yet I think it is important for us to be equipped with God's Word so that we know what the Bible says. If anyone asks you for your advice, or if you encounter a situation in marriage where you're wondering, is it time to divorce? I believe it's vitally important that we are equipped with God's Word to deal with this problem. But before we go into 1 Corinthians 7, I want to start with a survey of Bible teaching on marriage and divorce up to this point. And this is, I'm not going to be real comprehensive here, but I want to hit some highlights. One is, of course, the first mention of marriage in Genesis chapter 2, the end of Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. here is a two verbs. Leave, there's a leaving of the natural family ties, and a clinging, a cleaving, holding on, holding fast, and not letting go into this new family relationship of marriage. It's a strong word. Hang on, cleave, cling. There's no casuality in clinging. It's not a casual word. It doesn't produce an image in one's mind of well, maybe I'll let go sometime. But it's a strong word. And Malachi chapter 2, we see in the prophets a God's design for marriage. He says, Jehovah has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, the woman you married when you were young, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and the wife of your covenant. And did he not make one, although he had the remnant of the Spirit? And wherefore one he sought a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For I hate divorce, says Jehovah, the God of Israel. We have God's feeling towards divorce. It's not something that he feels fondly about or ambivalent about even. He says he hates divorce. He doesn't like it. And he's watching over the marriage of everyone who has covenanted together in marriage, watching to see, are you being treacherous to that marital vow? Now, he did permit divorce. Oh, sorry, I'm not there yet. Let me say one more principle here. Marriage was permissible with some people and not others. Moses married a Midianite woman. No condemnation for that, even though he didn't marry a Jewish woman. Deuteronomy 7, however, says that when Jehovah your God brings you into the land where you'll go to possess it, and will cast out many nations before you, the Hittite, the Girgashite, Ammonite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, and Jebusite, these seven nations, you shall make no covenant with them or make marriages with them. For they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. Thus you shall deal with them. Break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, hew down their asherim, get rid of all their idols, and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people unto Jehovah your God. There were people that God warned his people against marrying. Because, not because there was something, you know, superior about the Jewish ethnicity, but because he knew those particular people, those seven nations, would draw the hearts of his people away from their relationship with God to follow idols, and God didn't want that. However, he did say regarding other Gentile nations in Deuteronomy 20:21, just 14 chapters later, when you go forth to battle against your enemies, and Jehovah your God delivers them into your hands, and you carry them away captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you have a desire for her, you want to take her as a wife, bring her into your house. There's nothing inherently wrong with, you know, people who are different, even if they're a political enemy. God allowed marriage to all kinds of people. His only stipulation was, people that are going to turn your heart away from God, don't marry them. Okay, Exodus 21 also gives us some principles about marriage, and I mentioned them last week. Let me actually read the verse, Exodus 21, starting at verse 9. It's speaking of a slave owner. If he espouses an Israelite girl who's been sold into slavery and espouses her to his own son, he must not diminish her food, her clothing, or cohabiting with her. And if he does not do these three things, food, clothing, cohabiting, then she shall go out for nothing. She becomes free from her status as a slave without having to buy back her freedom. According to David Enstone Brewer, who is a senior research fellow in rabbinics and New Testament at Tyndale House, Cambridge, he says that Jewish marriage certificates that have been discovered in near the Dead Sea, dating back around the time of Christ in the New Testament, actually have these three marriage responsibilities from Exodus 21 written onto the marriage certificate as part of the contract. It was commonly understood that the neglect of these duties of food, clothing, and love were, if they were neglected, they constituted a breach of contract and were grounds for divorce. That was written right into their marriage certificates at the time among Jews during the New Testament. Now then, there's one more ground for divorce, which is mentioned in Deuteronomy 24. When a man takes a wife and marries her, then it shall be, if she finds no favor in his eyes, because he has found a thing of lewdness in her, that he shall write her a bill of divorcement, give it into her hand, and send her out of his house. And once he sends her away, he can't just take her back in to be his wife again. In an October 2007 article in Christianity Today entitled "What God Has Joined," this guy David Enstone Brewer, who's a professor of rabbinics and New Testament in Cambridge, offers the following explanation of what led up to the Pharisees' question to Jesus and about divorce in Matthew 19, and that's what Carl read. A few decades before Jesus, some rabbis, the Hillelite rabbis, invented a new form of divorce called the any-cause divorce. And it was based on Deuteronomy 24:1 that I just read to you, that if he finds a thing of lewdness, he may send her, write her a bill of divorcement. And what they said was, they could have said, if he finds lewdness, if he finds that she's committed an immorality, then he can write her a bill of divorce. But there are actually two words in the Hebrew. If he finds a thing or a cause of lewdness or immorality. And they said, well, this actually then is a list of two reasons why you can divorce your wife. You can divorce her if she's been immoral, or you can divorce her if something has happened. Maybe she's burned your food or anything you don't like. You can divorce for a thing, or you can divorce for immorality. Then another group of rabbis called the Shammaites said, no. They go together. It's a construct form, a thing of immorality. It's just immorality is the only ground for divorce listed here in Deuteronomy chapter 24. However, this any cause divorce, anything divorce, was very popular in Jesus' time, and many people had gotten divorces based on this interpretation of the Hillelite rabbis that said you can get divorced for anything, not just for immorality. And so that's the context when these Pharisees come up to Jesus and say, can a man divorce his wife for any cause? That's what they're asking. They're asking Jesus, do you side with the Hillelite school or with the Shammaite school in what is an appropriate grounds for divorce? And Jesus said, no, I don't approve of marriage for any cause. I approve of marriage of divorce only in the cause of adultery. So Jesus didn't approve of the any cause divorce, the no fault divorce. Jesus wasn't rejecting the Old Testament. He was rejecting a faulty Jewish interpretation of the Old Testament. He defended the true meaning of Deuteronomy 24:1, writes David Enstone. And there is one other surprising thing he didn't reject. He didn't reject the other ground for divorce in the Old Testament, which all Jews accepted, namely the three rights of food, clothing, and love. Another interesting thing about divorce in the Bible is that God instituted a divorce. Jeremiah 3:8 describes this. I saw when for this very cause that backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I, God, put her away and gave her a bill of divorcement. Yet treacherous Judah, her sister, feared not. She went out and played the harlot with stones and with sticks. Here God is speaking of His relationship with Israel and Judah as though it were a marriage relationship. And He's saying the northern tribes of Israel committed adultery in this relationship with God by worshiping sticks and stones, idols. And so God said, I had cause for divorce. I had grounds for divorce here, and so I divorced them. And they were sent off into captivity. So God Himself instituted one of these principles, although it was in a spiritual way, God Himself instituted a divorce. Now, what's the situation in Corinth? Paul here in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, what is the situation he is writing into? Let me give a little bit of background on that. Thistleton, who's one of the commentators that I read, quoted two Roman writers at this time period, one of them named Seneca. He wrote, "Few women seem to blush at divorce, and many reckon their years not by the number of consuls, but by the number of their husbands. They leave home in order to marry, and marry in order to divorce." Sounds like divorce was pretty common in those days among the Greco-Roman culture. Another writer, Tacitus, wrote during the Julio-Claudian period of time, and at the time of Nero, he said that divorce was widespread and readily enacted for a wide range of reasons, including social aspiration. I want to be richer. I'm going to marry a richer, divorce my poor husband and marry a richer man. Or personal taste. Don't like the color of his hair. Go marry another man. So divorce was a common problem in the culture to which Paul writes. In Corinth, there is an additional issue which was not so much an issue in the culture in which Jesus taught in Jewish Palestine. In Corinth, you had people from mixed marriages, especially people that had married as pagans, and then one of them became a Christian through the preaching of Paul or Apollos or whoever else had come through preaching the gospel. And so now you had marriages in which there was a Christian spouse and a non-Christian spouse. And now what do they do? This was not so much of an issue. Where the non-Christian spouse didn't even believe in a God, didn't even believe in any body of revelation that should govern how they live. Where Jesus was teaching around Palestine, at least, there was a common acknowledgement of the law of Moses, that, some kind of common understanding of God and His law that people were operating under. Here there are marriages where there were completely different and opposing understandings of how we should live. People must have wondered, if all things are new and I become a Christian, does that mean my marriage is new too? Do I have to leave it? Is living with a non-Christian going to contaminate or defile me in some way? Is it possible to live as a non-Christian and have a non-Christian spouse? There is one other issue in Corinth, that I've mentioned before, and that was this philosophy that that which is fleshly and physical is evil, and that which is spiritual and idea-oriented is good. And so there were people who were saying that the physical relationship in marriage is somehow dirty and unclean and something to be avoided. And we looked at that last week, the whole thing of do not deprive each other. There are people that were advocating depriving each other because they thought that the physical relationship of marriage was somehow bad and something to be avoided. And Paul says, no, it's not bad, it's good. Don't avoid it. Don't deprive each other. However, it's possible that there were some teachers that had come in and actually encouraged some of these Christians to divorce over this philosophy. They may have taught it's better to be single than to be married, because to be married is defiling because it's involving you in the physical world too much. I think that Paul's choice of vocabulary here in 1 Corinthians 7 supports this understanding of the issue, that perhaps there were people encouraging divorce in order to separate from defilement. If you look throughout the Bible and the Greek translation of the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, the standard words for divorce are apostasion and apaluo. But the words that Paul uses in this chapter here are two totally different words, koristeinai and aphiemi. And you don't have to know those words, but hopefully you can hear that those are different from the standard words for divorce. These two words that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 7 are generally used in the Greek Old Testament and in the New Testament to describe separating from what is unclean and unholy, not so much getting a divorce. It's possible. I'm going to skip on here. Keep moving. So let's step into now. Sorry, it's been a long introduction, but I felt like it's important to kind of understand what's going on as we dive into the text. Let's now look at verse 10. Verse 10, the main command that is given now then in the context of marriages and these uncertainties about is divorce okay or not and when is it, Paul says, and not just Paul but the Lord, this is an authoritative command of Scripture, the wife is not to be separated or divorced or is not to depart from or leave her husband. This is a passive verb in Greek, so I'm rendering it passive, not to be separated from. And likewise, the husband, in verse 11, is not to put away or divorce or dismiss his wife. Paul states the same principle for both men and women, because men and women are both equal before God under the law. Both men and women are of great value in God's eyes. And so... he takes the time to say it both ways. The main principle here is don't get divorced if at all possible. Paul says this command comes from the Lord, not just from his own apostolic authority, which would have been authoritative enough. This is because the wording in the command, do not be separated, comes directly from the only other place in the New Testament where this same word is used in regard to marriage and divorce, and that is Jesus's exposition of Genesis 2:24, which we have in Matthew 19:6. What God has joined together, let not man separate. There is Jesus' actual words on this topic. What God has joined together, let no one separate. And so Paul says this command comes directly from Jesus. It's a direct quote, or at least it's the actual word is a direct quote. Don't separate. We know that Paul had multiple occasions to talk with the apostles, other apostles who had heard Jesus teach personally. So Paul may have learned these words of Jesus directly from the apostles. It's also possible that some of the early Gospels had already been written by this time as well. Paul could have already read this in one of the Gospels. But whatever it is, he's quoting Jesus. It's not a suggestion from some ancient saint. It's a command from Jesus himself. And one thing to note, since Paul's referring to Jesus' command, and since Jesus' teaching at that point clearly says that divorce is acceptable in the case of immorality, we cannot say that Paul is contradicting Jesus' teaching by not mentioning divorce as a ground, not mentioning adultery as grounds for divorce. Adultery remains a legitimate grounds for divorce, although Paul just isn't mentioning it explicitly here. He's referring us to Jesus' teachings on the subject. Paul's concern has more to do not with couples that are dealing with adultery here, but rather with couples that aren't being intimate at all because they think it's unholy. And to them he says, marriage is good, it is worth preserving. Don't separate, if at all possible. Of course, we live in a messed up world, don't we? We can't, the standards, we're not going to always live up to them. People always fall short. So God gives a word through Paul in verse 11 to those who've already gotten divorced. And then later on in verse 15 gives a word to those who will get divorced in the future. Those who for some reason are not going to be able to follow the main command, don't separate. Isn't God gracious to think of us in our sin and make provisions for us in our sin? That he doesn't just dismiss us once we've failed the initial standard? That is awesome. And I hope that no one ever misses that. God is gracious. We've already seen in Exodus that one ground of divorce is a neglect of food, clothing, and love, and that should be a gross neglect, something that is verifiable in court. That means that your ability to stay alive and your ability to have children is in real threat. We've also seen that adultery can destroy a marriage covenant and be legitimate grounds for divorce. But what about those people who divorced for some other reason? What about all those people who got a for any cause divorce back in Jesus' day and then found out what Jesus said that was wrong? What about the Christians who had been deceived by these false teachers in Corinth and had already gotten a divorce thinking that they were separating from impurity? What about them? What if the damage of a destroyed marriage relationship is already done? It's too late for the don't be separated. Well, Paul has mentions two options here in verse 11. First, remain unmarried. It's wrong to interrupt a marriage, but it's worse to commit adultery wrongly by wrongly remarrying. So remain unmarried once the damage is done is one option. Remember, Jesus said, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another commits adultery. So two wrongs don't make it right. You can still serve the Lord effectively and be happy in an unmarried state. The second thing that Paul says in verse 11 is reconcile. Stay unmarried or get reconciled. The great Greek scholar A.T. Robertson comments that this word reconcile originally meant to trade coins, and it has a connotation of perfection or completion of the process. Everybody's satisfied. All the payment has been made properly, and everybody's happy again. If you've caused offense, apologize for it, and give whatever is necessary to make things right by your spouse. Be reconciled. This is consistent with God's call to us and God's relationship with us. 2 Corinthians 5, Paul wrote, God reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. because God reconciled us, we are to be reconcilers. That God was in Christ, reconciling the world to Himself, not reckoning unto them their trespasses, and having committed unto us the word of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors, therefore, on behalf of Christ, as though God were entreating by us. We beseech you, on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. Now, there is another situation which Paul does not address here, and it's the situation of you've divorced for a wrong reason and have remarried. Then what? You don't have the remain unmarried. You can't obey the remain unmarried because you've already remarried. And the reconciliation could also be out of the picture, although there may be, you may not reconcile to get remarried, but if you have already remarried someone else, but there may be other reconciliation to be done to preserve the friendship and the relationship, and not cause leave offenses unattended to. But what if you are an adulterer in God's eyes? What then? I want to briefly mention this, even though Paul does not. This is not the unforgivable sin. God still offers forgiveness of sin if you put your trust in His provision for the forgiveness of sin. And that is the death and resurrection of His Son, Jesus. If you will submit to the authority of Jesus in your life from here on out, rather than doing your own will, doing His will, there is forgiveness. You may have been an adulterer, but you can now be forgiven by God of that sin. And you can go on in relationship with God, with that sin dealt with. The pain and problems that come from it, naturally, may not all be removed by dealing with it before God, but they can become less when we get right with God. And you don't have to divorce from a second marriage. You don't have to divorce from a second marriage. Even that marriage can be good. And I've seen God bless at least one marriage that was a second or third marriage. They have had children in this marriage. I've recently celebrated a 25th wedding anniversary. And God has blessed them. They started anew. And God blessed that second or third marriage. So the one situation in which there might be a divorce then, that Paul addresses there in verses 10 and 11, is if there's already been a divorce, what do you do? Now in verses 12 through 16, he addresses another case of what if there will be a divorce in the future, what do you do? In verse 12, he says, as for the rest, and that's who he's referring to, these couples that are still together, but they're experiencing the stress of one marriage partner being a Christian, the other one not. And this particular situation wasn't explicitly addressed by Jesus. So Paul says that he's now speaking on his own, not quoting Jesus. Doesn't mean it's not authoritative. It would be saying that Paul's advice here is not authoritative would be like if you were a private in the army and a captain told you to do something and you said, well, I'm not going to do it unless the general says I have to. that private isn't going to last very long. Having different faiths is not grounds for divorce, says Paul. It can work as long as the unbeliever is pleased to dwell or willing or consenting to live with or literally of a good will together to cohabitate with the believer. There may be situations where, however, within the marriage where religious differences reach a point where there has to be a separation. We looked at one case earlier I don't want to spend time on this one this morning. One case may be the Ezra 9 and Nehemiah 9, where there was a wholesale turning away from God due to marriage with pagan wives. although let me just say that we don't have the same kind of legal system that they did at that time, and so we can't do things exactly like they did. The case that we have in 1 Corinthians 7, however, is where the unbeliever leaves because he's fed up with it. There's been no adultery, no neglect. They just don't feel like staying married anymore. Now what? What's a Christian to do? How's a Christian to respond to that? In this case, Paul says, the believer can let the unbeliever go peaceably and then consider themselves no longer bound by that marriage. Jesus warned us in Matthew 10:36 that a man's foes, once we become a follower of Jesus, our foes can be within our own household. And he gives two reasons for allowing the unbeliever to leave. In verse 15, he says, God has called us in peace. For some reason, the ESV decided to use the pronoun you. God has called you in peace. There's not adequate manuscript support for that. I don't know why they did that. All the other English texts say God has called us in peace. Not a big deal. Colossians 3:15 says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, into which you are also called in one body. We were called to the peace of Christ. To be ruled by the peace of Christ. You don't have to fight and disrupt the peace in an attempt to keep the unbeliever from leaving, Paul says. You can be at peace in your mind after they've left, that everything is okay. You've done what God has instructed you to do, and it's okay. You can be at peace if the unbeliever leaves. The second reason in verse 16 that is given for why you could allow the unbeliever to leave is in verse 16, it's that you are not in control of their salvation. Now, I know that John Calvin and some other people interpret verse 16 as a reason to stay married in hopes that they might be saved through your witness. But and that is a valid reason to persevere in marriage. 1 Peter 3 talks about that. We'll get into there in a minute. But I think because of the grammar of this verse, it's actually giving a reason to let the unbeliever go. You have no sure knowledge that you'll actually save them through your efforts if they stay. In other words, you aren't God. You can't save them. You don't even know who will be saved and who won't be saved. So you can't, and so you can leave salvation in God's hands rather than trying to control that unbelieving spouse. Now, there's a reason given for all of this in verse 14. And there's not time to go into that today. I want to save that as a sermon when we do the baptism for Ellie. But that reason that Paul gives is that holiness can be corporate. Holiness can be corporate. It's not merely an individual me and God thing, but there are ways of sharing holiness with other people and within groups of people. I'll just leave it at that as a teaser for whenever we get to that sermon on 1 Corinthians 7:14. But I want to close with four applications to these principles about marriage and divorce. And kind of go in order from before you're married to after a divorce. The first application: honor the sanctity of marriage by considering carefully before you marry. 2 Corinthians 6:14 instructs us not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Don't allow yourself to marry an unbeliever if you are a believer. That is going to cause stress in the marriage, and that's something you don't want. Consider carefully before you marry. How does that young man treat his mom? Notice that. how does that young woman treat her dad? You'll learn how she will treat you in marriage if you observe that. There are practical considerations. Is he able to provide food, clothing, and love? Is she a faithful person? Do they have the character and the skills necessary to sustain a marriage covenant? That should be considered. And your parents are generally good at considering that kind of thing. Even non-Christian parents are pretty good at seeing those things and should be consulted. You should get advice from as many people as you can before you get married, rather than regretting a bad decision later. You're stuck with whoever you marry, so you want to be singing, "I'm happy to be stuck with you." Second thing, honor the sanctity of marriage by marrying until death do you part. Honor the sanctity of marriage by marrying until death do you part. Don't go into marriage thinking you've got an escape, if it doesn't work out, we'll just call it off. Don't go into marriage thinking like that. Avoid divorce if at all possible. And when I'm not going to say if you encounter problems, when you encounter problems, get biblical counseling. Get help from wise, godly men and women. I've had to do it myself. Get help when you encounter problems. Don't distance from the church when those problems develop and think, people will think I'm not a very good Christian if my marriage isn't going so well. Don't be fooled. We've all had problems. One other point that I think is important to note is just because your partner has committed immorality or has neglected you does not mean that you have to divorce them. You still have the option to overlook offenses and maintain the marriage. Now there can come a time when you don't have the option to overlook that, and that's when your life is threatened. Or your children's life is threatened by what they're doing, by that neglect or immorality. Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant and Wayne Kirkpatrick wrote a song that I find powerful called "Love Can Do" that talks about this whole thing of the fight to cleave, to cling to your husband, your wife. Sometimes love means we have to stand and fight. Everybody runs, everybody hides. No, this ain't the movies, it's flesh and blood, and this thing I'm sure of. Hey, little girl running out so fast, you gotta stay put for love to last. Why you gotta say that love has gone away? It's not like that. Everybody hurts when the feelings fade. If you want them back, you gotta stay. No running. No running. Love is coming back like only love can do. So honor the sanctity of marriage by marrying until death do you part. And third, honor the sanctity of marriage by bringing covenant blessings into your family. Paul mentions peace in verse 15. You're called to peace. Are you bringing peace into your home? Are you an agent that when you walk into the room, things become peaceful? If not, what can you do to become an agent of peace? Ask God, please help me to become an agent of peace in my home. And that goes for kids too. You're not married, but you're part of a family. When you walk into a room, does peace erupt? Pray for God to make you one who brings covenant blessings into your family. Reconciliation is another one. Verse 11. Are you one who is bringing satisfaction to everybody involved? That everything's being made right when you relate to them. Beg God to be a faithful minister of reconciliation. Are you bringing the holiness of God into your marriage and into your family? Separation from sin and dedication to God. Bring that into your family. Holiness. And bring good behavior into your family to bless them. 1 Peter 3, we read responsibly, talking about husbands being won over by the behavior of their wives, not the lectures that they got from them, but beholding your chaste behavior coupled with your fear of God, and your meek and quiet spirit, with humility. And husbands in like same way, the way you dwell with consideration, kindness and thoughtfulness towards your wife, giving honor to her. Be compassionate, loving, tender-hearted, humble-minded, not rendering evil for evil or reviling with reviling, but rather with blessing. For to this you are called, that you should inherit a blessing. Honor the sanctity of marriage by bringing covenant blessings into your family. And finally, in the case of divorce, accept your freedom if all else has failed. Get biblical counsel first. Make sure it's a well-considered decision. As we read in the Westminster Confession, there it shouldn't be a private decision. It should be a public one. There's wisdom in that. But if you have to divorce, be thankful for this provision from God. Don't beat yourself up over it. If you have been divorced or abandoned according to biblical terms, you are free to remarry if you wish. You are. Or stay single if you wish. You're free. But whatever you do, honor the sanctity of marriage.